This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, February 24, 2004. At WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. Worldwide protests against the war profiteering of two giant American companies, Halliburton and Bechtel.
The employees of Bechtel should leave. This corporation has blood on its hands, and people shouldn't be working inside.
The Pentagon reports that in the next 20 years, climate change could cause a violent global battle for the remaining scarce resources, which could result in a nuclear war. And in the aftermath of the alleged police killing of an Aboriginal youth in Australia, leaked documents show that millions of dollars in stolen wages has been withheld from Aborigines. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Today, President George W. Bush is formally encouraging Congress to move forward on a constitutional amendment that would define marriage in the United States as being between one man and one woman. Bush said the issuance of marriage licenses to same-gendered couples in San Francisco and the Massachusetts court decision to allow the same in that state are issues of national priority. Bush claims the existing marriage law signed by former President Clinton is unable to prevent same-gendered marriage being accepted across the country in the event one state makes it legal.
The Constitution says that full faith and credit shall be given in each state to the public acts and records and judicial proceedings of every other state. Those who want to change the meaning of marriage will claim that this provision requires all states and cities to recognize same-sex marriages performed anywhere in America.
Representative Marilyn Musgrave of Colorado introduced such an amendment in the House, and there is a similar one already in the Senate. Legal experts thus far differ on whether that legal language will allow states to have civil unions. Relatives and hundreds of other mourners gathered at an outback New South Wales town to bid farewell to the Aboriginal teen whose death sparked last week's riot in the inner suburb of Redfern. Elise Pataka reports from Sydney.
Today, mourners in Sydney converged on the Redfern police station with a list of demands relating to Thomas Hickey's death. The 17-year-old died when he was impaled on a steel fence after coming off his bike. His family say he was being chased by police at the time, but police are denying the claim. Relatives and supporters called for an immediate royal commission into the boy's death and the standing down of the police officers they say were involved. Community spokesperson Kevin Smith.
He stood down from active duty for the outcome of all inquiries. Given that witnesses have now come forward to say that TJ was being chased by Redfern police at the time of the incident.
At the same time, local police have presented the New South Wales government with their own list of demands, including a call for a full parliamentary inquiry into Redfern. At this stage, they have the support of the New South Wales opposition party, but the government is making no commitment. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Elise Pataka in Sydney.
The U.S. Supreme Court overturned the death sentence of a Texas prisoner in a 7-2 ruling. Renee Feltz reports from KPFT in Houston.
Today, the High Court confirmed what defense attorneys for Dalma Banks have argued since his 1980 capital murder conviction. Dalma Banks' death sentence was won through prosecutorial misconduct, illegal testimony by a paid informant, and a dismal performance by his defense attorney, and should be reviewed. Previously, a federal court overturned Banks' conviction, but a Texas judge reinstated his death sentence. Today's court ruling means Banks can again press his appeal in lower courts. From KPFT, I'm Renee Felt for Free Speech Radio News.
Indian workers went on strike today, thumbing their noses at recent legislation and a court decision. Binu Alex has more from India.
Tens and thousands of government employees in India went on a day's strike today to protest against a Supreme Court order banning their right to strike. The business sources said the losses could be in the millions of dollars. The work in government offices, insurance firms, and banks were severely affected, with an estimated 1.5 million employees refusing to show up for work. Late last year, India's Supreme Court made illegal government workers' right to strike because of the disruption it causes to other citizens and the economy. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Binu Alex in Ahmedabad, India.
Jordanian activists are asking government officials why political dissidents are being picked up and held in secrecy. Ula Al-Farawati reports from Amman.
At least 75 prominent Jordanian figures have signed a memo protesting the arrest of Jordanian political activist Ali Smaid. The activist has been arrested by still unknown forces for secret reasons. According to the memo, Smaid is a well-known political figure who is vocal on opposing what they termed as governmental violations of law and international human rights codes and ethics. Jordanian authorities would not comment to Free Speech Radio News on Smaid's arrest. In Amman, Jordan, I am Ola Farawati reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Today, people came out around the world to call attention to the war profiteering of two giant American companies, Halliburton and Bechtel. We begin our coverage in London with reporter Naomi Fowler.
The demonstration outside the Bechtel building in a bitterly cold London today was one of 20 protests around the world. This one was called by Voices in the Wilderness, aimed specifically at Bechtel, the second largest contractor in Iraq. Emma Sangster from Voices in the Wilderness.
We're here to take part in an international day of protest against the corporate invasion of Iraq. It's a kind of second wave of invasion after the military.
John, also from Voices in the Wilderness.
The US taxpayer has been paying out tens of billions of dollars, but instead of the priorities being the Iraqi people's needs, the priorities seem to be for the Bush administration to give it out to its cronies.
My name's Eva Yashevich. I just got back from Iraq. I lived there for 8 months, and I'm here in solidarity with Iraqi people. They perpetuate this myth of Western expertise, corporate expertise, business expertise of companies, which, you know, the process is really simple. It's just ordinary people slaving their guts out, doing all the hard work, getting paid peanuts, and these people profiting. It's a structural issue. You can't just tell companies to be nicer or go somewhere else. They must cease to exist.
The consensus here today was that there should be independent monitoring of the funds going into Iraq in order to stop what protesters see as a second invasion of that country. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
Meanwhile, in New York City, activists wanted to expose the location of the secretive Bechtel Corporation. Ian Forrest was at the unmarked office building in Manhattan.
Bechtel and Halliburton!
In New York City, demonstrators who had come out to expose the location of one of the main profiteers of the Iraq War, the Bechtel Corporation. Protesters gathered at 21 East 40th Street to register their disgust at the way in which the corporation is benefiting at the expense of U.S. soldiers and taxpayers and the lives and livelihoods of the Iraqi people. Simon Harrock is with the War Resisters League and is one of the organizers for the New York City rally. For him, the double role Jack Sheen, a vice president of Bechtel, who also serves as a member of the Defense Policy Board, is a clear sign that the motive to go to war was driven by the opportunity to profit from it.
If we don't invade, they don't get as much money. If we do invade, then they get a lot of money. Well, what do you think they're going to advise him to do?
Organizers are hoping these and other demonstrations will bring about increased public awareness, which will eventually make the individuals involved accountable for their actions. Reporting for FSRN in New York, I am Ian Forrest.
Investigative reports from Iraq have shed light on the work that is being done to fulfill the multi-billion dollar contracts by both Bechtel and Halliburton. Prothap Chatterjee, managing editor of CorpWatch, joins us to talk about his investigations. So Prothap, you've just returned from Iraq where you were investigating Bechtel rebuilding sites. Tell us some of the things you found.
The schools we visited had new sewage systems that led nowhere. Brand new sewage covers, no drain. We visited schools which had new Japanese fans installed by UNICEF, and these were taken away by local contractors employed by Bechtel and replaced by cheaper Syrian fans that didn't work. So the story we encountered again and again was of poor planning, government incompetence, and greed, which seems to be the hallmark of every contract in Iraq. The problem is that we're hiring the most expensive companies in the world to do the simplest jobs. The question is this: would you hire the biggest engineering company in the world to fix your toilet, or would you take the Concorde from New York to Hartford, Connecticut? The answer is no, because it would be too expensive. And this is what's happening in Iraq. Iraq has qualified engineers who can fix school toilets and paint buildings, yet we're paying $20,000 to fix a school the local contractors can do for $2,000.
One of the things that's in the news today is the meals that are being charged to the army. What did you find out about that when you were there?
Halliburton is charging $28 a day to feed every soldier. Now, for $28 a day, you can eat at the finest restaurant in Baghdad, such as the White Palace restaurant, which Paul Bremer eats at. The Pentagon has found that Halliburton has charged us, the taxpayer, for cooking 42,000 meals in July 2003, when they only prepared 14,000 meals. Henry Bunting, for example, a Halliburton employee who testified before Congress 2 weeks ago, said the company routinely bought the most expensive items, like custom embroidered towels. At the same time, the company encouraged their procurement supervisors to group purchases in lots of under $2,500 so that they could escape audit scrutiny. For example, this meant batching together small purchases, like towels, or splitting more expensive items, like video cameras, into two purchase orders so they could be presented on different days. So we, the taxpayer, are being overcharged by these companies because they think they can get away from that. And the Pentagon really needs to oversee this and make sure that we're not being overbilled and that Iraqis get decent services in return for the money that's being spent on these companies.
Prithap Chatterjee is the managing editor of CorpWatch. Three directors from different intelligence and investigative agencies testified at a rare open session of the Senate Intelligence Committee concerning threats to the U.S. CIA Director George Tenet told the committee that the victories by Iranian conservatives in the parliamentary elections is of concern. FBI Director Robert Mueller said that al-Qaeda is still intent on attacking U.S. locations, including the White House and the Capitol. However, none of the heads of intelligence agencies mentioned a Pentagon report warning that the greatest future threat could be climate change. The report, in a worst-case scenario, suggests that in the next 20 years, climate change could cause a violent global battle for remaining scarce resources, which could result in a nuclear war. Mitch Jeserich reports.
Surrounded by a dozen bodyguards, CIA Director George Tenet, FBI Director Robert Mueller, and Defense Intelligence Agency Director Admiral Lowell Jacoby marched into the hearing of the Senate Intelligence Committee, where all three answered unequivocally that the United States is safer today than before the invasion of Iraq. Still, Tenet said he's concerned over the steady global growth of al-Qaeda and other groups that may attack the U.S., and Tenet assumes the Iranian government will work towards developing nuclear weapons, especially as conservatives were victorious in last weekend's elections.
Iran claims its centrifuge program is designed to produce low-enriched uranium to support Iran's civil nuclear program. This is permitted under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, but here's the downside. The same technology can be used to build a military program as well. The difference between producing low-enriched uranium and weapons-capable high-enriched uranium is only a matter of time and intent, not technology.
During questioning by committee members, Tenet could not state with certainty that Iran is developing nuclear weapons. But ranking Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, Jay Rockefeller of Virginia, says it's going to be hard to act on intelligence after the failures over Iraq.
It now appears that Iran has had a much more advanced WMD capability and much closer links to dangerous terrorists than Saddam Hussein ever did. But our credibility has suffered because we have not found WMD in Iraq, and I fear we now will find it much harder to build international consensus support to deal with Iran, should that be necessary.
Republican chair of the Intelligence Committee, Senator Pat Roberts of Kansas, urged lawmakers not to ask Tenet about the intelligence failures on Iraq, saying the hearing was meant to examine current threats. But that didn't stop Democratic Senator Carl Levin of Michigan.
Now, Vice President Cheney just a few weeks ago said the following, that those trailers were in fact part of the biological weapons program. Do you agree with Vice President Cheney?
Well, sir, there's one side that thinks one thing and one side that thinks another thing. So in fairness to him, I think he was going off of an older judgment that was embodied in a paper.
Was that older judgment the one that is still on your website?
Yes, sir.
Why is it still on your website?
Sir, we just keep adding. We had a piece of paper at a moment in time. We've added David Kaye's piece of paper. I put my Georgetown speech on it.
What is the Intelligence Committee's assessment of whether or not 9/11 hijacker Muhammad Atta met with Ahmed Al-Ani.
My recollection is we can't prove that one way or another.
Neither the heads of the CIA, DIA, or FBI brought up a Pentagon report that says the greatest global threat in the next 20 years could be climate change. The report, uncovered by Fortune magazine, painted a worst-case scenario that suggested a change in global temperature may result in a drastic depletion of resources, igniting a global conflict that could lead to nuclear war. Daphne Weisham is the director of Sustainable Energy and Economy Network.
India has almost 1 billion people. China has over 1 billion. All you need is a mass exodus from one part of that region to potentially result in an escalation of military tensions that could bring on nuclear war. You know, for example, have one of our most densely populated regions of the U.S., parts of California, go completely dry. The sad thing is that what this report is concluding is that we need to sort of arm ourselves to the teeth.
The Bush administration, as well as Congress, have yet to acknowledge the report. I'm Mitch Jezerich for Free Speech Radio News.
A Minneapolis man, Mohammed Wassam, seems to be the latest victim in the government's continuing policy of mass detentions. Wassam was a student and a tutor at the Minneapolis Community and Technical College, where he was arrested December 9. A Canadian citizen of Somali descent, Wassam had moved permanently to the U.S. in 2002 to live with his American wife and child. In late January, he was served with a one-paragraph indictment charged with conspiracy to provide material support to Al-Qaeda. From Minneapolis, Kristen Lerstrom and Kerry Byron have the story.
Unidentified law enforcement officials have stated that Mohammed Warsami was first contacted as part of the investigation of Zacharias Moussaoui. In August of 2001, the French-Moroccan Moussaoui was arrested in Minneapolis and is currently on trial as the alleged 20th hijacker. After being approached by the FBI in early December 2003, Warsami agreed to a voluntary interview. Chuck Samuelson is the executive director of the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union.
Somewhere in that process, according to the paper, he confessed to having been at Al-Qaeda camps in Afghanistan when Osama bin Laden was there, and furthermore that he had enrolled in these camps under an alias, and that's enough to get him afoul of the USA Patriot Act.
Held for nearly 6 weeks without charges, on January 20th, Warsami was indicted for conspiracy to provide material support to Al-Qaeda. Even once Warsami's attorney, Chief Federal Public Defender Daniel Scott, was informed of his client's legal status, the two were still unable to confer. At issue were special administrative measures imposed by Attorney General John Ashcroft, restricting Scott's ability to counsel the defendant. The U.S. Attorney from Minnesota, Tom Heffelfinger, explains the intent behind special administrative measures.
They attempt to strike a balance between protecting the security of the country and a detained individual's right to have access to his lawyers and to visitors and things necessary for him to mount his defense.
It's that balance that has worried observers in the case, most notably Dan Scott. When faced with the directive, Scott stated he did not want to sign something that would infringe on his client's rights. On February 3rd, the defense and prosecution reached an undisclosed agreement allowing Scott and Warsami to begin planning their defense. However, the increasing use of tactics such as special administrative measures are troubling to many observers. Bruce Nestor, the immediate past president of the National Lawyers Guild, attributes this trend to the heightened post-9/11 public scrutiny of the U.S. government. Such a situation, Nestor says, increases the administration's need to appear confident and effective.
In general, the government has used very broad and perhaps unconstitutional statutes to sweep up people who have only a limited connection to groups or activity that might be classified as terrorists. And so the use of special administrative measures strengthens the hand of government prosecutors in cases that, frankly, are often weak to begin with. And I believe it's really primarily done for political purposes and to try to create an atmosphere that the Department of Justice is being effective in protecting our security.
Experts have observed that the cultivation of such an atmosphere has come with an unprecedented level of secrecy. Throughout much of December and January, federal prosecutors refused to admit to Warsami's arrest. Omar Jamal is the executive director of the Minneapolis-based Somali Justice Advocacy Center. He says that the government's emphasis on secrecy in this case risks basic constitutional rights of presumed innocence and proper legal representation.
Of course, if anyone is arrested, there's a very basic clerk procedure. The person shows up at the court, information is recorded, it's accessible to the public. All that were denied. Frederick Douglass once said that the challenge of this country is to live up the promise of its constitution. They have to live up to the constitution here, and that's all we are asking for. Warsame is an individual. He comes and goes. But what doesn't come and goes is the constitution.
Warsame has been held in solitary confinement since December 9th. His bail was denied 2 months later. With Carrie Byron from KFAI in Minneapolis, this is Kristen Lerstrom for Free Speech Radio News.
Turkey's most celebrated political prisoner, Leyla Zana, will remain behind bars for at least another month. This after Turkey's state security court opted to continue the retrial of the jailed Kurdish politician Zana and three other former members of the Turkish parliament. The Kurdish politicians have been in jail for almost 10 years now, but thanks to pressure from the EU, they're getting a new trial. FSRN correspondent Özlem Sarıyıldız files this report from the courthouse.
Dozens of friends and family gathered outside the state security court in downtown Ankara in support of jailed Kurdish politician Leyla Zana. When Zana and her colleagues were elected in 1994, it was the first time in the history of Turkey that members of a Kurdish party had been elected to parliament. But when they tried to take the oath of office in Kurdish to call attention to the fact that the Kurdish language is banned in Turkey, the parliament was surrounded by police. And after 3 days of passive resistance, Zana and her colleagues were arrested. Now, they are getting a new trial, but few observers are optimistic. Canadian filmmaker Gia Gol spoke with Zana's family before court opened.
I talked to the people, I talked to the expert as a journalist. I felt that most of them, they were pessimistic in the beginning of the court. They say, well, this is going to be the result, and exactly what happened, what they said.
Friends closed the Paris-based station, the popular Kurdish satellite channel Met TV, under pressure of Turkey, which claimed the channel promoted terrorism. Kurdish activists in Turkey say they won't talk about the trial until Met TV is allowed to broadcast again. Overall, though, it is pressure from Europe that got Zana and her colleagues a new trial to begin with. Turkey wants to join the European Union, and the EU says it won't admit Turkey until the government improves the human rights situation. The EU 2002 Human Rights Report gives Turkey until December 2004 to release the jailed parliamentarians. That pressure may not be enough to free Zana, though. Faruk Bal of the Nationalist MHP party says Zana should not be released just because Europe wants her out.
I think because the EU is afraid of the population and enormity of Turkey, they want to accept Turkey in pieces. Turkey is a big and powerful country. Turkey wants to be accepted to the EU with this size and power, so Turkish people know where the sources of the 17-year war in southeastern Turkey come from. The fact that the EU is trying to get old problems to blossom again shows it is insincere.
Nationalists like Faruk Bal see little difference between politicians like Leyla Zana and what he calls terrorists, armed Kurdish guerrilla fighters who fought the Turkish army for close to 20 years in an unsuccessful effort to win an independent Kurdistan. Leyla Zana's nephew, Jenny Güneş, aggressed, the armed resistance and Zana's political activities are linked. But, he says, that doesn't make her a terrorist.
Bir grup silah kullanıyor.
One group is struggling in the political arena when another is struggling with arms. In such a situation, you have to be concerned with the armed group. Ultimately, all Kurdish political parties are accepting of the armed groups and try to pull them into the unarmed arena. That is the only relation between them.
Leyla Zana will be back in court March 12th. Each new court date could mark her release. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Özlem Sarıyıldız in Ankara, Turkey.
As we reported in the headlines, Indigenous peoples across Australia today mourned for the life of Thomas Hickey, who was killed last week after being chased by police. And after the funeral concluded, Aboriginal leaders called for their people's issues to be put squarely on the national agenda, one of which is the millions of dollars in wages that were stolen from Aborigines. Just weeks ago, a leaked cabinet submission revealed that successive New South Wales governments knowingly withheld millions of dollars in trust funds from their rightful Indigenous owners. Christine Baker reports from community radio station 2SER in Sydney.
Between 1900 and 1970, the New South Wales government took tens of millions of dollars in trust funds from Aboriginal workers, mothers and children, claiming they were unfit to handle their financial affairs. The government may have claimed they were keeping the money safe, but the bulk of Indigenous people never saw any of their money again. Marjorie Lawson is one of these people. Removed from her family as a child, she was raised in a girls' home and sent off to work as a domestic when she was 15.
But I had to get up like at 4 in the morning to attend to my duties every day, 7 days a week. We never had a holiday. And we never seen any money. I knew that my bosses paid my wages and that they were sending the wages in to the government every time it was due. And I knew that it wasn't the people we worked for while we didn't get the money. They were told they had to send the wages direct to the government.
Marjorie's been fighting to reclaim her wages for the past 20 years with no success. And she's not alone. All of Australia's states are grappling with the problem of how to return money held in trust to their rightful owners. The New South Wales government recently made the news when a leaked cabinet document revealed that successive governments had an unwritten policy of denying liability and refusing access to the money. What's more, some of those funds are now long gone, stolen in some cases by the very people who were meant to keep it safe. Australia's only Aboriginal senator, Aidan Ridgway, says resolving the issue is of utmost importance to Aboriginal welfare.
Every Aboriginal person is affected, either directly or as a result of being a descendant of someone that was put out as a domestic. Because people didn't get their proper entitlements or wages, they had no capacity, therefore, to be able to build up a wealth base to be able to look after their kids or grandkids. So the reality is that Indigenous people become part of this vicious welfare cycle. It's not just a question of saying, let's pay a lump sum of anywhere from $2,000 to $4,000, as the Queensland government have suggested. It's also a question of looking at the principle of intergenerational equity. What other things could have been done, and how do we redress that for the current generation of Indigenous people?
Senator Ridgway says he'll call for a Senate inquiry if the New South Wales government doesn't act soon. Meanwhile, the government say they're considering a new submission on how to repay the money. New South Wales Premier Bob Carr.
Trying to unravel history, the history of injustices to Aboriginal people, involves some difficulties. The difficulty is that many of the Aboriginal people are no longer alive. The difficulty that records are inadequate, but if there's a way of doing it, of returning money to people from whom the money was stolen, we will do it.
Until these issues are resolved, Rick Griffiths from the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Commission says we can expect further expressions of anger from the Aboriginal community.
It's an issue of the current government start and have respect for black people around Australia and more importantly in New South Wales. You know, we continue to get marginalised by all governments. And there's a lot of rhetoric around about, you know, reconciliation and social justice. But that's all it is empty rhetoric.
Rick Griffiths, from the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Commission. I'm Christine Baker, reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Sydney.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.